Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season 5 of the Common Grounds Unity Podcast. Jesus valued unity and prayed for it. We believe unity begins with Jesus-centered relationships, gathering around a table, sharing a cup of coffee or a meal. We like to say unity begins with a cup of coffee. So grab a cup and let's get started with another episode of the Common Grounds Unity Podcast.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining us for part two of our discussion about emotionally healthy spirituality with David Bruce.
It is very ironic that even the concept of emotional intelligence is such a recent discovery, if you will, in the field of psychology, because again, going back to when you look at the Bible narrative, emotion is probably on every single page of the Bible. So to live a Christian life not familiar with, not recognizing feelings or the value of distinguishing them, right, from our thoughts, I mean, this is just where I think the field of psychology is helping us see things that were already in the Bible, right? The psychology is not coming up with anything new. I think they're just recognizing things that have been there the whole time.
Well, welcome to another conversation. So glad to have you back with us today. David Bruce is our guest, and David is a licensed marriage and family therapist. He's an addiction counselor and serves also as an elder at Turning Point Church up in Los Angeles. David, Peter Scazzaro, he wrote, and this is a quote, a little bit of a lengthy quote, and then I'm going to ask you a little bit about its relevance and for you to unpack some of these ideas in just a moment. But he wrote, sure. "The reality, however, was that my discipleship and spirituality had addressed neither my insecurities nor my understanding of myself. Breaking free would require learning to feel, learning to distinguish feeling and thinking, and finally summoning the courage to follow my God-given true self rather than the voices and demands around me." So talk to us a little bit about the relevance of that statement and unpack some of those ideas, if you would.
Yes. First of all, there's some very important statements there, right? Learning to feel, learning to distinguish feeling and thinking. First of all, one of my heroes in the psychology world is a gentleman by the name of Dr. Daniel Goleman, who actually wrote the book Emotional Intelligence about 20, 25 years ago. It is very ironic that even the concept of emotional intelligence is such a recent discovery, if you will, in the field of psychology. Because, again, going back to when you look at the Bible narrative, emotion is probably on every single page of the Bible. So to live a Christian life not familiar with, not recognizing feelings or the value of distinguishing them, right, from our thoughts. I mean, this is just where I think the field of psychology is helping us see things that were already in the Bible, right? The psychology is not coming up with anything new. I think they're just recognizing things that have been there the whole time. So, and this kind of goes back to that whole external versus internal. I think what Peter's describing there is that our discipleship and our spirituality can be very functional and very behavioral kind of oriented. Like we walk the right walk and we go to church. We do a lot of the right things. But I think sometimes we're doing a lot because we don't want to feel a lot. And that's a very interesting concept. And this is where, you know, this is where I see the, you know, sort of the tragedy in my dad's life. You know, I know my dad when he was a minister, right? I mean, my dad worked very hard to establish and build a church. I mean, he went, this is back in the 60s when you go door knocking to try to sell church bonds to get enough funds to build a church from the ground up. But I remember my dad later telling me that, you know, he felt like he was the only one with that responsibility of quote unquote being the spiritual person in the body, right? Or in the church. Mm-hmm. And I know that that exasperated my dad. It exasperated him. And at the same time, I know that, you know, my dad, I think growing up in a very emotionally immature spiritual context didn't allow him to really value or even understand the value of his own emotions. It was basically do well, you know, seem spiritual, do spiritual things, but at the same time having like no recognition, you know, of what's going on internally. So I think really what I witnessed growing up was when my dad got out of the ministry and got sort of stepped away from the faith, it's almost like my dad hit his adolescence in his 30s because he was never allowed to really have his adolescence when he was a kid because, you know, that behavior or those emotions are not welcome here. Just do the right thing, go to church, you know, do your discipleship, do your spirituality, but don't be engaged with what's going on internally. And so I think to Peter, I mean, reading Peter's, Peter's very vulnerable in the book. I mean, he talks about, you know, thriving as a minister, being very successful as a minister. And yet there was this internal just storm inside going on that was not being addressed. And I think that's really what he's describing in that quote. He uses the word courage. It takes courage to look at and understand our own emotions, our own vulnerabilities, our own stories. And one of the greatest definitions of courage I've ever heard, I think it was Desmond Tutu that said, courage is not the absence of fear, but it is the decision that there is something more important than fear. And I think that's when God and God's intent to lead me, develop me, help me mature, when I see that that is more important than my fear, God can evolve me any which way he wants. I mean, now I'm on the right track where he's a part of that process, right? And, you know, fear can be very overwhelming at times, but I think in some ways, this is why emotional maturity is not just in the church or has been in the inside of the church, has been outside of the church, is because there's a lot of hesitation to go where your parents didn't go or your culture hasn't gone. You know, how many cultures say boys don't cry? I mean, right there, there's an emotional handicap being implanted in a very young soul that says, okay, man, those emotions, not okay. And, you know, proceed otherwise, you know.
I think one of the impressive things about Scazzaro's writing is his transparency and vulnerability. And if you, you know, read him, I've listened to him on Audible with Emotionally Healthy Leadership. There's something about hearing him speak and other authors speak rather than write that's sometimes helpful. I think we can learn something from his transparency about just the benefit and growth that came through an open, honest assessment of backgrounds and formation in family of origin and things of that nature, and how it spilled over into his own ministry and life and the things that brought him here. That's hard for leadership sometimes and people in those positions. So let's talk a little bit about emotionally healthy leadership. In your role, not only are you a therapist, you're an elder in a church, you're in church leadership. How do you look at and assess church health? in those roles? And what role does psychology play in the spiritual development, not only of individuals, but communities? You touched on that a little bit earlier.
Right. Well, one overwhelming concept that I found very instrumental is Peter introduces one model. I know there's many models out there, but just the whole idea that there are stages of faith, or there are stages of growth in one's faith. I think that's a very important idea, because I think for many years, I just thought you either have faith or you don't. It was very black and white. You know, do I really trust God today or do I not? But the idea that there are different stages of faith, first of all, working in a church community with that in mind, I think allows us to have a lot more grace and a lot more curiosity about being okay with wherever someone is in their stages of faith. So one thing that's very helpful about understanding growth in stages is that everyone's in that process at some point. The goal is not to condemn the people that are not in your current stage of faith. And I think that's something that can create a lot of tensions in churches. Like, you know, here I am, I've been through my wall. I've been through my great trials, right? And now what's wrong with the rest of you that you're so immature and, you know, you're still at the basics and all that kind of stuff. And we almost like look down on people that are in different stages of their faith. But to see that God's love and God's intent is there, whatever stage of faith that you're in. And I hope this doesn't distract the point, but I listened to an interview once of a gentleman who is he's a grief specialist. And he was being interviewed and they asked him, is it not true that most marriages end in divorce when there has been the loss of a child? Okay. Now, statistically, that is true. However, this grief expert really pushed back on how that stat was being presented, because when you hear it, it's almost like it's the child's fault that the parents' marriage ended in divorce. And he said, I do not think that is appropriate at all. It is not the child's death that resulted in the divorce. What ends in divorce is when two people judge one another's stages of grief. Mm-hmm. So if one spouse is at, you know, let's call it the denial stage of grief, and the other one is in the anger stage of grief, and just using that particular model of the different stages of grief, well, then you look at each other and you go, well, you're off, you're wrong. Why aren't you at my stage, you know, where I'm really mad about this? And why aren't you mad with me? So again, what's interesting about that is he said, what you have to do is you have to help that marriage by separating the husband and the wife and allowing them to have their own support network based on the stage of grief that they are in, right? So that's very interesting, but there's a translation there. It's the same thing with people's stages of faith. Like, hey, don't condemn that brother because he's in a different stage of faith, but perhaps as a leader, I need to look at what is the appropriate support that a person needs if they're in that earlier, you know, maybe less mature stage of their faith, right? And maybe what are different resources that are needed with someone who's already been through the wall or been through a great difficulty in their faith and have come through it on the other end? What does their support look like? So again, I think that's where leadership, if it can understand that, first of all, God and the Holy Spirit are very involved in people's development. God is totally for that. I think the Holy Spirit that's part of his main agenda, is teaching and reminding so that you develop. But then as a leader, to make sure that we're recognizing what are the appropriate resources at the different stages of one's faith, rather than the conflict and the judgment of one another in our different stages of faith. And that's where I think, to the second part of your question, I think that is where there are a lot of resources these days, as psychology is, I think, less and less stigmatized. And I'm not saying that psychology is it is not a pure religion. Psychology definitely has some issues. It's not all good. But I do think there are the healthiest parts of psychology are the aspects that really, I think, reflect biblical principles and biblical standards of life. And part of that is the whole field of emotional intelligence. Another hero of mine in the field of psychology is a gentleman by the name of Martin Seligman, who's the founder of positive psychology. And what Martin Seligman did when he was president of the American Psychological Association is he basically kind of gave a big rebuke to the entire field of psychology. And what he said was, guys, we've been at this for, you know, about a century now, but I have to admit, the field of psychology is primarily focused on pathology and what is wrong with people. And I know what he's talking about, because my very first hour of grad school was opening up this big, thick book called the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, this whole book of every potential pathology that a human being can have, right? That was welcome to psychology, right?
Starting what a out downer. With all the disorders.
Right. What a bummer problem, right? But I found that interesting, because I could see what Martin Seligman just did to psychology. I felt convicted, because I think sometimes that's what I've done as a Christian. Is in my Christian standpoint, I look at what is everyone doing wrong? What are people in the world doing wrong? How are people in sin? How are we going to get people out of sin? So we've been very behavioral and sometimes overly sin-focused rather than spirit-focused, which, according to Galatians 5, if you're more spirit-focused, it almost resolves the sin issue, right? And again, I think that's where, and I learned this from my own addiction experience, trying really hard not to sin all week did not result in me being a more spiritual person. In fact, I got pretty tired and cranky and frustrated just resisting trying to say no to something, but not knowing how to say yes to the Holy Spirit, how to say yes to emotions and wounds that needed to be heard and understood and talked about and processed, which I think is totally available in a Christian community that's focused on, you know, supporting people in their growth journey.
Yeah, it gets a little bit, you cite Galatians 5, and I think about, you know, Paul giving the fruit of the Spirit, then saying, against such things there is no law. You know, it's as if you're setting your heart, trying to keep in step with the Spirit's desires for your life. That brings a much better outcome than just sin resistance.
That's right.
That's good, David. One of the later chapters of Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, there's a brief story from Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov, that had significance to you and a real pleasant reference point. Tell us about that, if you will.
Thank you. First of all, it was very interesting to see Dostoevsky show up in this Emotional Healthy Spirituality book. Dostoevsky, along with Tolstoy, had a very important influence on my life. But that story that is mentioned in the book, it's the main character of the book speaking to this woman who is really struggling to understand God. Like, can I really believe in a God, right? And he basically tells her, you know, really the only way to really understand God is to understand love. And really, you know, trying to you know, loving people will help you really discover, you know, God. And so this woman admits that, you know, she's had these dreams, these fantasies of being a saintly woman and being of great service to the poor and sacrificing herself. Like, I get so excited thinking about doing that. And I feel like, wow, that's what a life with God could be like. But then I imagine people not being grateful. I imagine the poor people complaining about my service or critiquing my service. And when I think about how overwhelming and painful that would be, I just quit. And then I realize I can't believe in God. And that's where he says this one line, love is a harsh and dreadful thing compared to love in our dreams. And I mean, that quote is not easy to hear because it's like, wait a minute. I like the warm and fuzzies of love. I like the pleasantness of love. But I think what he's really trying to say is, I think one of the things that emotional healthy spirituality talks about is that pain is sometimes a very helpful nudge and motivation for change. But trying to live your life without pain almost starts to compound it. And I think that's where, and this is where I think Christianity, as we practice healthier Christianity, I think we will be much more authentic and talking about how, you know, the Christian life, it is not easy and there are pains to it, but those pains are not without purpose. Sometimes pain is growth trying to happen. And to quote another gentleman that I really admire a lot, Viktor Frankl, who was this Jewish psychologist who survived the Holocaust, he made this very interesting observation. He said, somehow suffering ceases to be suffering once it meets meaning or purpose. Mm-hmm. And I think we will have a much richer and more valuable and more effective Christian walk when you realize, you know what? Pain is not to be avoided, but especially since most of our negative emotions feel uncomfortable, we will do a much better job being still with those emotions and trusting God with those emotions than striving really hard to not feel them or to dismiss them, right? So it's a much more richer and I think authentic walk when we can understand that and accept that.
Well, that's good. Good, David. David, this has been a great conversation. I'd love to have you back for more.
Oh, thank you.
And I could just continue with this. Real quickly, for people that are wanting to move towards greater emotional, healthy spirituality, what are a couple of just practices you would suggest or a couple of pathways that you would say, here's a good starting point?
Yeah. Well, one, I would highly recommend reading the book, Emotional Healthy Spirituality, as it is. Yes. It is a very, well, I consider it a very good book that includes a lot of practical theology. Theology for me can sometimes sound and seem very, you know, intellectual, and I got to, heady, very heady. But man, practical theology is very grounding, you know, pardon the pun. Mm-hmm. But I think, so some of the things I would encourage people to do, well, one, I would just say, really don't hesitate to open up a really healthy degree of curiosity about your inner world. Like, taking your inner world a little bit more seriously. One skill or practice that I started after reading EHS is I began a daily exercise of journaling. Because what I noticed is when I feel things, one of the things that we do to avoid how we feel is we distract ourselves with thinking. And so if I'm feeling a little irritated And then I go to a lot of thoughts to try to get relief from that very uncomfortable feeling of irritated. Well, now I've just flooded my brain with 100 thoughts and I'm more confused. But when you journal, one of my first supervisors told me that journaling is one way of taking your thoughts more seriously. Mm. So my daily practice today and for the past few years has been, I do journal my prayers. I journal my dilemmas. I journal my victories. I mean, I write out many of the things that I want to express and communicate to God, because when thoughts are in the head, they're so muddled and it's so cloudy and there's so much going on in there. But guess what? When you write things down, it concretizes it and it helps you sort of filter and see perhaps some of the more important parts that need to be communicated or expressed. So I find that a very centering exercise, just the practice of journaling or writing out things. And neurologically, by the way, that is really important, because when you're writing things down, you're forcing the activity of your limbic system, where your emotional center is, you're forcing it through the prefrontal cortex, which is the rational part of your brain. So just the practice of writing out thoughts and things that you're going through, it's a very brain-regulating exercise, and you will most likely feel a little bit more balanced and less cluttered when you start that type of practice. So,
boy,
that's one strong recommendation I would make. Yeah.
I appreciate that. Well, Dave, we're going to have to bring our conversation to a close. I want to ask a quick question. You're right up the road from me. If I were to drive up to Los Angeles and we were to go have a cup of coffee, our whole kind of motif here is unity starts with a cup of coffee. And,
excellent.
How do you take your coffee? And do you got a favorite coffee shop up there in your part of Los Angeles?
You know what? I'm going to bend the rule a little bit, because I was just in Oklahoma visiting my mother. And in Norman, Oklahoma is this coffee shop called the Yellow Dog Coffee Shop. And they have this latte called Rob's Way, which has lavender, honey and oat milk. And oh, I'm telling you, it's just criminal. Whenever I go back to Oklahoma, I pop $8 a pop every time I get that drink. And somehow the guilt just doesn't stick. I keep going back the next day for another one of those. So yeah, maybe if you come up, we'll find a compromise local. But if we ever meet in Oklahoma,
I think I'm ready to go to Norman with you.
Okay, there we go. Let's do it. Go Sooners.
And it's a happy place after that game recently between the Sooners and UT, right?
Yes. Don't get me started. But yes. Okay.
All right. Well, so good to have you with us, David. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've just been a great guest, and what a great conversation. And I know this is a blessing to those kind of listening in. I feel like I got a bit of a free session with a really good therapist and Christian leader. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
I want to say that to those that are listening, we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another Common Ground Unity podcast. But we have a vision. Our vision is to create and support gatherings of unity-minded Christians around the globe. Imagine the good news of these gatherings, modeling the prayer of Jesus in our divided world, bringing believers together in rich fellowship and service. So if you have an interest in becoming a part of a gathering or forming one, let us know how we can help. There's ways there in the show notes and at our website. And if you're benefiting from this ministry, please consider a monthly donation. You can go to www.commongroundunity.org/donate. A lot goes on through this ministry. Those of us that are serving, we serve in a voluntary way, but it costs to put podcasts together and websites and push essays out and do all the work that we're trying to do to bring together streams of this movement and believers around the world. Thank you for listening to the Common Grounds Unity podcast. Please check out commongroundsunity.org to learn about who we are and to find gatherings in your area. You can also subscribe to our monthly digital newsletter, join the Facebook group, or find our YouTube channel. Until next time, God bless, and remember, unity starts with a cup of coffee.